History's Book 2, Euterpe. Upon Cyrus's death, Cambyses took over the kingship, being Cyrus's son by Cassandane, daughter of Pharnaspes. Her death, which occurred earlier, had caused Cyrus himself deep grief, and he had commanded every one of his subjects to observe mourning for her too. So Cambyses, son of this woman and of Cyrus, treated the Ionians and Aeolians as slaves inherited from his father and launched a military expedition against Egypt, taking along others of his subjects, and in particular the Greeks he ruled. Now the Egyptians, before Psammitichus became their king, believed that they themselves were the first of all people to come into being. But when Psammitichus, having become king, wished to know who had been first, from that time on they believed the Phrygians had come into being before themselves, and all other peoples after themselves. Psammitichus, since he was unable by inquiry to find any way to discover who the first people had been, devised the following scheme. He gave two newborn children of ordinary parents to a herdsman to raise among his flocks, with instructions of a certain kind. No one was to utter any word in their presence. They were to be left lying by themselves in a lonely hut. At the proper time, he was to bring goats to them, and having satisfied them with milk, tend to the rest of his business. Psammitichus did and ordered these things because he wanted to hear, once the children were past their meaningless babbling, what word they would burst out with first. And this is exactly what happened. For after a span of 2 years had passed with the herdsman doing this, one day as he opened the door and went in, both children fell before him and said, "Because," stretching out their hands. The first time he heard this, the herdsman kept quiet about it, but since it kept happening again and again as he came and tended to them, and this word was repeated so much, at last he reported it to his master, and at his command, brought the children into his presence. Psammitichus himself, having heard it, inquired who called anything because, and inquiring further he discovered that the Phrygians call bread by that name. On these grounds, the Egyptians conceded, having judged the matter by such evidence, that the Phrygians were older than themselves. That this is how it happened I heard from the priests of Hephaestus in Memphis. The Greeks, however, tell many other foolish stories, among them that Psammitichus had the tongues of certain women cut out and had the children raised in that manner in the company of these women. So much did they tell me concerning the rearing of the children, but I heard other things too when I went to Memphis and spoke with the priests of Hephaestus. Indeed, I turned aside to Thebes and to the city of the sun for this same purpose, hoping to learn whether their reports would match what I had heard at Memphis. For the people of the city of the sun have a reputation as the best informed of all Egyptians. As for what they told me concerning divine matters, I have little wish to lay it all out, apart from just naming the gods, since I take it that everyone understands such things equally well. But as for I do bring up any of it, I will only do so because my narrative leaves me no choice. When it comes to human affairs, though, this is what they said, and here their stories matched. The Egyptians were the very first people anywhere to work out the year, splitting it into 12 segments corresponding to the seasons. They claim to have worked this out from observing the stars. And to my mind, their method beats the Greek one, in that the Greeks add an extra month every third year to keep pace with the seasons, whereas the Egyptians count the 12 months at 30 days apiece, then tack on 5 extra days each year beyond that total, so that for them, the cycle of seasons returns to its starting point exactly. They also said the Egyptians were the very first to fix names for the 12 gods, which the Greeks then borrowed from them. That the Egyptians were the first to dedicate altars, statues, and temples to the gods, and the first to carve animal figures into stone. And regarding these matters, most, in fact, they showed had really happened that way. They said that the first man to become king of Egypt was Min, and that in his time all of Egypt except the Thebaic district was marsh, and none of the land now lying below Lake Moeris existed above water, the voyage up the river to that place from the sea being 7 days. And what they told me about the land struck me, too, as sound, for it is obvious even without hearing it beforehand to anyone with sense who simply looks. That the Egypt the Greeks sail to is territory the Egyptians gained and a present from the river, and this applies also to the region beyond this lake as far as a 3-day sail, about which the priests told me nothing more of this sort, though the same holds true. For the character of the land is this. First, while you are still approaching by ship, a full day's sail from shore, drop a sounding line and you will pull up mud, finding yourself in 11 fathoms. This alone reveals just how far the silt deposits of the land extend outward. Next, the length of Egypt itself along the coastline runs 60 skoine, by our reckoning of Egypt stretching from the Plinthinite Gulf to Lake Cerberus, beside which Mount Cassius stretches. From this point, then, the 60 skoine are reckoned. Those peoples who are short of land measure their country in fathoms, those who have somewhat less shortage in stadia, those who have much land in parasangs, and those who have land to excess in skoine. A parasang is equal to 30 stadia, and the skoinos, an Egyptian measure, is equal to 60 stadia. So the coastline of Egypt would be 3,600 stadia. From there inland as far as Heliopolis, Egypt is wide, all of it flat, waterlogged, and muddy. The road from the sea up to Heliopolis is about the same length as the road from Athens, from the altar of the 12 gods, leading to Pisa, and to the temple of Olympian Zeus. One who calculated it would find the difference between these two roads to be small, not more than 15 stadia in length. For the road from Athens to Pisa falls short of 1,500 stadia by 15, while the road from the sea to Heliopolis comes to that exact number. From Heliopolis upward, Egypt is narrow. On one side, the mountain range of Arabia stretches, running from north to south and always further, up toward the sea called the Red Sea. In this range are the stone quarries from which the pyramids at Memphis were cut. There the range ends and bends back to where I have said. On the other side, where it is at its very longest, as I learned by inquiry, it takes 2 months to travel from east to west, and its eastern extremities produce frankincense. Such, then, is this mountain range. On the Libyan side of Egypt, another mountain range stretches, a rocky one, in which the pyramids are, covered over with sand, running in the same manner as the part of the Arabian range that runs toward the south. Now from Heliopolis, the land is no longer wide as Egypt goes, but for about 14 days' sail up the river, Egypt is narrow, the land between the mountain ranges mentioned being flat, and the stadia seem to me to be, where it is narrowest, not more than 200, from the Arabian mountains to the one called the Libyan. Beyond that, again, Egypt is wide. Such, then, is the nature of this land. From Heliopolis to Thebes is a voyage upstream of 9 days, the distance being 4,860 stadia, there being 81 skoina. Adding up these stadia of Egypt, the coastal part I have already stated above at 3,600 stads, and I will now note the distance from the sea inland as far as Thebes. It comes to 6,120 stads. From Thebes to the city called Elephantine measures 1,800 stads. Of this territory just described, the greater part, according to what the priests told me, seemed to me too to be land acquired by the Egyptians. For the region between the mountain ranges mentioned, which lie above the city of Memphis, appeared to me once to have been a gulf of the sea, just as, to compare small things with great, the region around Ilium and Teuthrania and Ephesus and the plain of the Meander are. For of the rivers that have silted up those regions, the Nile, having 5 mouths, none of them can be matched in volume to even a single one of them. There are also other rivers, smaller than the Nile, that have nonetheless produced great effects. Among them I can name several, not least the Aklis, which runs through Acarnania and, emptying into the sea, has already converted half the Echinades islands into dry land. There is also, within Arabian territory, a short distance from Egypt, an arm of the sea that reaches inland from what is called the Red Sea, remarkably long and narrow, as I shall describe. Its length, measured from the innermost point out to the open sea, takes 40 days by oar. Its width, at the Gulf's broadest point, spans half a day's sail. And within it, the tide rises and falls every single day. I think that Egypt too was once a gulf of just this kind, the one running in from the northern sea toward Ethiopia, and the other, the Arabian one which I am about to describe, running in from the southern sea toward Syria, their inner ends nearly boring through to meet each other, differing only slightly in position. If then, the Nile should wish to divert its course into this Arabian Gulf, what is there to prevent it from being silted up by this river's flow within, say, 20,000 years? For my part, I expect it could be silted up even within 10,000 years. If that is so, then in the time that has already elapsed before I was born, could not a gulf even much larger than this one have been silted up by so great and so hardworking a river? Regarding Egypt, then, I am convinced those who make this claim are correct, and I myself am strongly of the same opinion. Having observed that Egypt projects out beyond the surrounding land, that shells turn up on the mountains, and that a crust of salt forms on the surface strong enough to corrode even the pyramids, and that the only mountain in Egypt bearing sand is the one above Memphis. Moreover, that its soil bears no resemblance to neighboring Arabia, and Egypt bears no resemblance to Libya, nor to Syria either, since the coastal stretch of Arabia is settled by Syrians, but rather its earth is dark and fissured, being in fact mud and silt carried down from Ethiopia by the river. We know, by contrast, that Libyan soil runs redder and sandier, while Arabian and Syrian soil is more clay-like and stony. This, too, the priests told me as a great proof concerning this land, that in the reign of King Moeris, whenever the river rose as little as 8 cubits, it would irrigate the Egypt that lies below Memphis. And Moeris had not yet been dead 900 years when I heard this from the priests. But now, if the river does not rise at least 16 or 15 cubits, it does not overflow onto the land. And it seems to me that the Egyptians who live below Lake Moeris, in the other regions, and especially in the area called the Delta, if this land continues in due proportion to increase in height and grows correspondingly in extent, then, once the Nile no longer floods it, they will for all the rest of time suffer the very thing which they themselves once said the Greeks would suffer. For having learned that the whole land of the Greeks is watered by rain and not by rivers as their own is, they said that the Greeks would one day be disappointed of a great hope and suffer badly from hunger. What this saying means to convey is that, if the god is unwilling to send them rain, but instead afflicts them with drought, the Greeks will be overtaken by famine. For indeed for them there is no other source of water apart from Zeus alone. This much has been fairly said by the Egyptians regarding the Greeks, but let me now lay out how things stand for the Egyptians themselves. If, as I noted earlier, the land below Memphis, which is the part still expanding, should continue to rise in elevation at the same rate as in the time gone by, surely nothing else could happen but that the Egyptians who live there would go hungry, if their land gets no rain and the river is unable to overflow onto the fields. As it is now, certainly, these people harvest crops from the earth with less toil than anyone else in the world, including the rest of the Egyptians. They have no toil breaking open furrows with a plow, nor hoeing, performing none of the labor other peoples put into raising a crop. Instead, once the river rises on its own, floods the fields, and then withdraws again, each farmer sows his own plot and drives swine over it, and once the swine have trampled the seed into the soil, he simply waits for the harvest. Then, after thrashing the grain with the same swine, he brings it in. Now, if we wish to adopt the opinion of the Ionians about Egypt, who say that only the delta is Egypt, reckoning its seaward part from the so-called watchtower of Perseus all the way to the salting houses of Pelusium, a stretch of 40 skoinae, and saying that from the sea it extends inland as far as the city of Cercosorus, where the Nile splits and flows toward Pelusium flowing on toward Canopus, and claiming that the remainder of what makes up Egypt belongs partly to Libya and partly to Arabia. By this reasoning, we would be showing that the Egyptians once had no land of their own. Their delta, as the Egyptians themselves claim and as I too believe, is ground built up by river deposit and has appeared, one might say, only in recent times. If then, they had no land of their own to begin with, why did they bother imagining themselves the first people ever to exist? Nor would they have needed to run their experiment on the infants to discover which language the children would speak first. But I do not think the Egyptians came into existence at the same moment as the delta the Ionians describe, nor that they have been around since humanity itself began. Rather, as the land kept extending, some of them stayed put where they already were while others kept moving further down. At any rate, in ancient times Thebes was called Egypt, and its circuit is 6,120 stadia. If then we judge rightly about these matters, the Ionians are not thinking correctly about Egypt. But if the Ionians' opinion is correct, I demonstrate that the Greeks, the Ionians themselves included, do not know how to calculate, since they say the whole earth consists of three parts, Europe and Asia and Libya. They would need to count a fourth region as well, the Delta of Egypt, if it belongs to neither Asia nor Libya. For by this reasoning, the Nile can hardly be the river marking the border between Asia and Libya, since the Nile forks around the tip of this delta, leaving the delta positioned between Asia and Libya. As for the Ionians' view, we set it aside, and instead we hold the following position. All the territory inhabited by Egyptians counts as Egypt, just as Cilicia is what the Cilicians inhabit and Assyria what the Assyrians inhabit, and we recognize no genuine boundary between Asia and Libya other than the frontiers of Egypt. But if we adopt the usage current among the Greeks, we will treat all of Egypt as split in two, starting from the cataracts and the city of Elephantine, with each half claiming both names, part belongs to Libya, part to Asia. For the Nile, starting at the cataracts, runs down through the center of Egypt, dividing it all the way to the sea. Up to the city of Cercosorus, it flows as one single channel, but from that city it splits into three channels. One turns toward the east, and this is called the Pelusiac mouth. The second of the channels runs toward the west, and this is called the Canopic mouth. But the straight course of the Nile among these channels is this one. Coming down from above, it reaches the point of the delta, and from there splitting the delta down the middle, it empties into the sea, carrying a share of water that is neither smallest nor least famous. This branch is called the Sebennytic mouth. Two further mouths branch off from the Sebennytic and also reach the sea. They bear the names Sadic for one and Mendesian for the other. The Balbatine and Bucolic mouths are not natural mouths, but dug channels. Supporting my opinion that Egypt is as large as I show it to be by my account is also the Oracle of Ammon, which I learned of after forming my own opinion about Egypt. For the people from the city of Meria and from Apis, who inhabit the parts of Egypt bordering on Libya, believing themselves to be Libyans and not Egyptians, and resenting the religious restrictions on sacrifice, not wanting to be forbidden from eating female cattle, they sent word to Ammon claiming they had nothing whatsoever in common with the Egyptians. For they lived outside the delta and shared no customs with them, and wished to be free to eat anything at all. The god, however, would not permit them to do this, declaring that this land was Egypt, the very land the Nile waters as it comes over it, and that those were Egyptians who lived below the city of Elephantine and drank from this river. Thus was this oracle given to them. And when it is in flood, the Nile overflows not only the delta, but also, in places, parts of what is called the Libyan region and the Arabian, for a distance of 2 days' journey on each side, and sometimes more than this and sometimes less. As for the nature of the river, I was unable to learn anything either from the priests or from anyone else. But I was eager to learn this much from them, why the Nile comes down in flood, beginning at the summer solstice, for 100 days, and then, drawing near to the end of that number of days, recedes again, falling short in its stream, so that it remains low throughout the whole winter until the summer solstice comes around once more. On none of these points was I able to get any answer from the Egyptians when I asked them what makes the Nile behave contrary to every other river. And hoping to understand what I have just described, I also asked why it alone among rivers gives off no breezes. Yet certain Greeks, eager to appear clever, have put forward three different accounts concerning this water. Two of these accounts I hardly think deserve mention, except to point them out in passing. One holds that the Etesian winds cause the river to swell by blocking the Nile from draining into the sea. Yet the Etesian winds have often failed to blow at all, and still the Nile behaves the same way. Furthermore, if the Etesian winds were the cause, then the other rivers too, all those that flow against the Etesian winds, ought to be affected in the same way and to the same degree as the Nile, and all the more so as, being smaller, they have weaker currents. But there are many rivers in Syria and many in Libya which are affected by nothing of the sort that affects the Nile. The second explanation is less scientific than the one just mentioned, though more remarkable to tell. It holds that the Nile's behavior comes from its flowing out of the ocean, a stream that circles the whole earth. The third of the explanations, though by far the most plausible, is nonetheless the most mistaken of all, for it too says nothing true, claiming that the Nile flows from melting snow, a river which flows from through the middle of Libya, through the Ethiopians, and comes out into Egypt. How then could it flow from snow, given that its course runs mostly from the hottest regions toward cooler ones? For a man capable of reasoning about such things, it is not even plausible that it flows from snow, and the winds provide the first and greatest proof of this, blowing hot as they do from these regions. Second, that the country continues rainless and without frost, and after snow falls, it is absolutely necessary that rain fall within 5 days, meaning that snowfall in those regions would necessarily bring rain there as well. And third, the people are black from the heat. Kites and swallows remain there the whole year and do not leave, while cranes, fleeing the winter that occurs in Scythia, migrate to these regions to winter there. If then it snowed at all in this country through which the Nile flows and from which it begins its course, none of these things would happen, as necessity proves. As for the man who spoke of ocean, having carried his account back into the realm of the unseen, he offers no proof. For I myself know of no river called ocean existing, but I think Homer, or one of the poets who came earlier, coined the name himself and worked it into his verse. If, having found fault with the opinions put forward, I must myself declare an opinion about these obscure matters, I will explain why I think the Nile rises in summer. In the winter season, the sun, driven from its former course by the storms, travels over the upper parts of Libya. To put it as briefly as possible, that is the whole matter. For whatever country this god is nearest to and directly over, it stands to reason that that country is most thirsty for water, and the local streams of its rivers shrink. But to explain it at greater length, this is how it is. As the sun passes over the upper parts of Libya, it does this. Since the air in those regions is clear at all times, and the country is warm and the winds are cold, in passing over it does what it is accustomed to do in summer when passing through the middle of the sky. It draws the water to itself, and having drawn it, it pushes it away into the upper regions, and the winds take it up and scatter it and it dissolves. And it makes sense that the winds blowing from that region, the south wind and the southwest wind, are by far the rainiest of all winds. And it seems to me that the sun does not send away all of the Nile's water year by year, but retains some of it as well. When the winter grows mild, the sun departs back to the middle of the sky, and from then on it draws equally from all rivers alike. Meanwhile, the other rivers, having much rainwater mixed in with them, since the land is rained upon and cut with ravines, flow in flood. But in summer, when the rains fail them and they are drawn upon by the sun, they run weak. The Nile, however, having no rain and being drawn upon by the sun, alone of rivers at that time, naturally flows itself much lower than in summer. For then it shares its draw evenly among all the waters, yet in winter it bears the strain alone. Thus I have come to believe the sun is the cause of these things. This same sun, in my opinion, is also the cause of the air there being dry, since it scorches its own path, and so summer holds the upper parts of Libya continually. But if the position of the seasons had been reversed, and where the north wind and winter now stand in the sky, there the south wind and the midday position had stood instead, and where the south wind now stands, there the north wind stood. If this were so, the sun, driven from the middle of the sky by the winter storm and the north wind, would travel over the upper parts of Europe just as it now travels over Libya. And passing through the whole of Europe, I expect it would do to the Danube what it now does to the Nile. As for the breeze, why it does not blow off the river, I hold this opinion. It is not plausible that any breeze should blow off very hot regions at all. A breeze tends to blow from something cold. So let these matters stand as they are, and as they were from the beginning. As for the sources of the Nile, no one, neither Egyptian, nor Libyan, nor any Greek that I have talked with, has claimed to know them. Except in Egypt, in the city of Sais, the scribe in charge of the sacred treasures of Athena. He, it seemed to me, was joking when he claimed to know for certain. This is what he said. There are two mountains with peaks rising to a sharp point, one lying near the city of Sine in the Thebaid, the other near Elephantine, and the mountains are named Crophi and Maphi. The sources of the Nile, being bottomless, flow from between these mountains, and half the water flows toward Egypt and the north wind, while the other half flows toward Ethiopia and the south. As proof that the springs are bottomless, he said that Psammetichus, king of Egypt, once made trial of this, for he had a rope woven of many thousand fathoms and let it down there, and it did not reach bottom. So said the scribe, if indeed he was describing things that actually occur, showing me, as far as I could understand, that there are certain strong eddies there and a backflow, so that, since the water strikes against the mountains, the sounding line let down cannot reach bottom. From no one else was I able to learn anything at all. But this much further, the farthest extent, I learned. As far as the city of Elephantine I went myself and saw with my own eyes, and beyond that I inquired only by hearsay. Going upward from the city of Elephantine, the land rises steeply. There one must tie ropes to the boat on both sides and proceed as with an ox, and if the boat breaks loose, it is carried off by the force of the current. This region is a 4 days' voyage, and the Nile there winds like the meander. There are 12 skoini which one must sail through in this manner. And then you will arrive at a smooth plain in which the Nile flows around an island. Its name is Tacompso. The land above Elephantine is now inhabited by Ethiopians, and half of the island as well, the other half by Egyptians. Adjoining the island is a great lake, around which nomadic Ethiopians graze their herds. Sail on through it, and you will reach the Nile's channel, which flows into this lake. And then, disembarking, you will make a journey along the river of 40 days. For sharp rocks project in the Nile, and there are many reefs, through which it is not possible to sail. Having passed through this stretch in the 40 days, you board another boat and sail for 12 days, and then you will reach a large city named Meroe. People say this city serves as the capital of all the other Ethiopian peoples. The people there worship only Zeus and Dionysus among the gods, and honor these greatly, and Zeus has an oracle set up among them there. They go to war whenever this god commands them through oracles, and wherever he commands, there they go. From this city, sailing on for an equal span of time again, you will arrive at the deserters, in the same time it took you to travel starting at Elephantine and ending at the Ethiopian capital. These deserters are called Asmach, which word, in the Greek tongue, means those who stand at the left hand of the king. These, 24 myriads of the fighting men of the Egyptians, deserted to these Ethiopians for the following reason. In the reign of King Psammetichus, garrisons were stationed at Elephantine against the Ethiopians, another at Daphne in the Pelusiac region against the Arabians and Assyrians, and another at Maria against Libya. The Persian garrisons still hold those same posts down to my own day, just as they did under Psammetichus. For indeed at Elephantine the Persians keep guard, and at Daphne as well. Now these Egyptians, having stood guard for 3 years, were relieved by no one from their duty. So they took counsel together, and by common agreement all revolted from Psammetichus and went off to Ethiopia. Psammetichus, on learning of it, pursued them, and when he overtook them, he begged them at length, urging them not to abandon their ancestral gods and their children and wives. To this one of them is said to have pointed to his genitals and said that wherever that was, there they would have children and wives. These, when they arrived in Ethiopia, gave themselves over to the Ethiopian king, who repaid them in this way. There were certain men among the Ethiopians who had become disaffected toward him. These he bade the Egyptians drive out and settle in their land. Once these men had been settled among the Ethiopians became gentler, having learned Egyptian customs. Now as far as a 4 months' voyage and journey the Nile is known, apart from the stretch of it within Egypt. For that many months are found, on reckoning, to be spent traveling from Elephantine to these deserters. It flows from the west and the setting sun. Beyond that point no one can say for certain, for that country is desolate because of the heat. But I heard the following from men of Cyrene, who said that they had visited the shrine of Ammon and struck up conversation with Eterchus, king of the Ammonians, and that somehow, from other topics, they came to talk about the Nile, how no one knows its sources, and that Eterchus said that once some Nasamonian men had come to him. This tribe is, to the Libyan Sea, and they inhabit the Syades and the land east of the Syades for not a great distance. When the Nasamonians came and were asked whether they had anything further to report about the deserts of Libya, they said that among them there had once been sons of powerful men, insolent youths, who among other extravagant schemes, when they had grown to manhood, cast lots to choose five of their own number to go and see the desert parts of Libya, and to see if they could learn anything beyond what those who had already gone farthest had witnessed. For as to Libya, the parts along the northern sea, beginning from Egypt and running all the way to the promontory of Salawis, the point where Libya ends, are inhabited throughout by Libyans and many tribes of Libyans, except where Greeks and Phoenicians hold territory. But the parts above the sea and above the peoples who dwell along the sea, the region further inland, is full of wild beasts. And beyond the beast-infested land there is sand, terribly waterless, and desert of everything. So the young men, sent off by their peers, well provisioned with water and food, went first through the inhabited country. And having passed through that, they came to the beast-infested land, and from there they made their way through the desert, directing their course toward the west wind. After passing through a great stretch of sandy country, after many days they saw trees growing in a plain, and when they approached and were picking the fruit that was on the trees, small men came upon them, smaller than men of ordinary stature, and seized them and led them away. The Nasamonians understood nothing of their language, nor did the men leading them understand anything of the Nasamonians. They led them through vast marshes, and once they had made their way across, they reached a city whose inhabitants all matched their captors in height and were black in complexion. Past the city flowed a great river, flowing from west to east, and crocodiles could be seen in it. So much, then, for the account of Eteocus of the Ammonians, which I will leave off here, except to add that he said the Nasamonians returned home, as the Cyrenians told me, and that the people they had reached during their journey were, every one of them, sorcerers. As for this river flowing past the city, Eteocus supposed it to be the Nile, and indeed reason leads to that conclusion. For the Nile flows out of Libya and cuts through the middle of Libya, and, as I conjecture, inferring the unknown from what is evident, it takes its rise at distances corresponding to those of the Ister. For the Ister River, beginning among the Celts and the city of Pyrene, flows through the middle of Europe, dividing it. The Celts live beyond the pillars of Heracles, bordering on the Cynesians, who dwell furthest west of all the peoples settled in Europe. And the Ister ends flowing into the sea at the Euxine Pontus, at the place where the Milesians colonists inhabit Istria. Now the Ister, since it flows through inhabited country, is known to many. Yet nobody is able to say anything about where the Nile begins, for the region of Libya that it crosses lies empty and uninhabited. Concerning its course, as far as inquiry could take me, I have spoken, and it issues into Egypt. Egypt lies more or less opposite the mountainous part of Cilicia. From there to Sinope on the Euxine Pontus is a 5 days' journey in a straight line for a man traveling light, and Sinope lies opposite the Ister where it flows into the sea. So I think that the Nile, running through the whole of Libya, corresponds in length to the Ister. Let this much, then, be said about the Nile. I now proceed to speak at length about Egypt, because it has more marvels than any other land and displays works beyond description compared with any other country. For these reasons, more will be said about it. The Egyptians, along with having a climate peculiar to themselves and a river with a nature different from other rivers, have established in most respects customs and practices the opposite of other men. Among them, the women buy and sell in the marketplace, while the men stay at home and weave, and whereas other peoples weave pushing the woof upward, the Egyptians push it downward. Men carry burdens on their heads, women on their shoulders. Women urinate standing up, men sitting down. They relieve themselves indoors, but eat outside in the streets, explaining that what is shameful but necessary should be done in private, while what is not shameful should be done openly. No woman serves as priest to any god, male or female, but men serve all gods, both male and female. There is no compulsion on sons to support their parents if they do not wish to, but daughters are under every compulsion to do so whether they wish it or not. Elsewhere, priests of the gods wear their hair long, but in Egypt they shave it. Among other peoples, the custom in mourning for those most closely affected is to cut the hair short, but the Egyptians, upon a death, let their hair grow long, both on the head and on the chin, having previously kept it shaved. Among other peoples, the way of life is kept separate from that of animals, but among the Egyptians, their way of life is shared with animals. Other peoples live on wheat and barley, but for an Egyptian to make his living from these is the greatest disgrace. Instead, they make their bread from emmer wheat, which some call spelt. They knead dough with their feet, but clay with their hands, and pick up dung with their hands as well. Other peoples, except those who have learned it from the Egyptians, leave their private parts as they were born, but the Egyptians circumcise. Each man has two garments, each woman one. Other peoples fasten the rings and ropes of their sails on the outside, but the Egyptians on the inside. In writing letters and reckoning with pebbles, the Greeks move the hand from left to right, but the Egyptians from right to left. And doing this, they themselves say they write to the right, and that the Greeks write to the left. They use two kinds of script, one called sacred, the other common. Being exceedingly religious beyond all other men, they observe practices such as these. They drink from bronze cups, scouring them fresh every single day, not some but all of them. They wear linen garments always freshly washed, taking special care of this. They circumcise themselves for cleanliness' sake, valuing purity over a more attractive appearance. The priests shave their whole body every third day, so that no louse or any other foul thing may come upon them while they attend upon the gods. The priests wear only linen clothing and sandals of papyrus. No other clothing or other sandals are permitted them. They bathe in cold water twice each day and twice each night, and they perform countless other rites, so to speak. Yet they also enjoy no small benefits. They spend nothing of their own property and are put to no expense, but sacred food is baked for them, and a great quantity of beef and goose is given to each of them every day, and wine of the grape is given them as well. But they are not permitted to taste fish. Beans the Egyptians do not sow at all in their land, and those that grow wild they neither eat nor cook and eat. Indeed, the priests cannot even bear to look at them, considering the legume unclean. Each god is served not by one priest but by many, of whom one is chief priest, and when one dies, his son succeeds him. They believe the male oxen belong to Epaphus, and for that reason they test them in this way. If the examiner finds even a single black hair on the animal, he judges it unclean. One of the priests appointed to this task examines the animal both standing and lying on its back, pulling out its tongue to check whether it is clean of the prescribed marks, which I will describe in another account. He also examines the hairs of the tail to see whether they grow according to nature. If it is found clean in all these respects, he marks it by winding papyrus around its horns, then applying sealing clay and pressing a signet ring into it, and so they lead it away. For sacrificing an unmarked animal, the penalty is death. This, then, is how the animal is tested. Here is how they carry out the sacrifice itself. Bringing the marked animal to the altar where they intend to sacrifice, they kindle a fire. Then, pouring wine over the victim upon the altar and calling upon the god, they slaughter it, and having slaughtered it, they cut off the head. The body of the animal they flay, but upon the head they lay many curses and then carry it away. Those who have a market and resident Greek merchants carry it to the market and sell it, while those who have no Greeks among them throw it into the river. They pronounce these curses upon the heads, saying that if any evil is about to befall either those performing the sacrifice or Egypt as a whole, let it turn upon this head. Now regarding the heads of the sacrificed animals and the pouring of the wine, all Egyptians alike follow the same customs for all their sacrifices, and because of this custom, no Egyptian will taste the head of any living creature. But the manner of removing the entrails and burning them differs from temple to temple, according to each one's practice. But I will now speak of the one they hold to be the greatest deity, to whom they hold the greatest festival. When they have flayed the ox, having first prayed, they remove the whole belly, leaving the entrails in the body along with the fat, and they cut off the legs and the loin, the tip of it, and the shoulders and the neck. Having done this, they stuff the ox's remaining carcass with pure loaves, honey, raisins, figs, frankincense, myrrh, and other aromatic substances, and having filled it with these, they burn it, pouring on abundant oil. Having fasted beforehand, they sacrifice, and while the offerings are burning, all of them beat their breasts. And when they have finished the beating, they set out as a feast the parts that were left over from the offerings. Now all Egyptians sacrifice the male oxen and the calves that are pure, but they are not permitted to sacrifice the females, since these are sacred to Isis. For Isis's cult image shows a woman bearing cow horns, just as the Greeks depict Io, and the Egyptians all alike revere cows far more than any other cattle. For this reason, no Egyptian man or woman would kiss a Greek man on the mouth, nor use a Greek man's knife, spits, or cauldron, nor taste the meat of a pure ox that has been cut up with a Greek knife. Here is how they dispose of oxen that die. The females get thrown into the river, while each community buries its males in its own suburbs, with the one horn, or both, sticking up as a marker. And when it is rotted and the appointed time has come round, a barge arrives at each city from the island called Prosopitis. This island lies in the delta, and its circumference is 9 skoinae. On this island of Prosopitis, there are also many other cities, and it is from the one from which the barges come to collect the bones of the oxen, called Adarbekes, in which a holy shrine of Aphrodite is established. From this city, many others set out for other cities, and having dug up the bones, they carry them off and bury them all together in a single place. In the same way as they do with oxen, they also bury the other livestock when they die, for concerning these two they have laid down the same law, they do not kill these either. As for those who have established a shrine of Zeus of Thebes, or belong to the Theban district, all these abstain from sheep and sacrifice goats instead. For not all Egyptians alike revere the same gods, except Isis and Osiris, who they say is Dionysus, these two all alike revere. But those who possess a shrine of Mendes, or come from the district around that city, abstain from goats and sacrifice sheep instead. Now the Thebans and those who abstain from sheep on their account say that this law was established for them for the following reason. Heracles wished at all costs to see Zeus, and Zeus was unwilling to be seen by him. Finally, when Heracles kept pressing him, Zeus contrived this device. He flayed a ram, cut off its head, and holding the head in front of himself, put on the fleece, and thus showed himself to Heracles. From this, the Egyptians make the image of Zeus with a ram's face, and from the Egyptians the Ammonians do likewise, being colonists of both the Egyptians and the Ethiopians, and using a language that is a mixture of both. And it seems to me that the Ammonians took their very name from this, for the Egyptians call Zeus Ammon. The Thebans hold rams sacred rather than sacrificing them, and that is the reason. Yet on one day of the year, at the festival of Zeus, they cut up a single ram, flay it, and dress the image of Zeus in its skin in the same way as before, and then they bring up another image, of Heracles, close to it. Having done this, all those about the shrine beat themselves in mourning for the ram, and afterward they bury it in a sacred coffin. Concerning Heracles, I have heard this account, that he is one of the 12 gods. As for the second Heracles, the one familiar to the Greeks, I could nowhere find anyone in Egypt able to tell me of him. And indeed that the Egyptians did not borrow the name Heracles from the Greeks. Rather, it was the Greeks who took it from the Egyptians, specifically those Greeks who gave Amphitryon's son the name Heracles. Of this, I have many other proofs as well, and among them this one, that the parents of this Heracles, both Amphitryon and Alcmene, were, as it happens, descended originally from Egypt. And also that the Egyptians say they do not know the names of either Poseidon or the Dioscuri, nor are these gods reckoned among their other gods. And yet, if indeed they had taken the name of some deity from the Greeks, it is these above all others that they would have been likely to remember, if in fact they were then already using ships, and if some of the Greeks were seafarers, as I both suppose and my own judgment inclines me to believe, so that the Egyptians would have come to know the names of these gods even more readily than that of Heracles. No, Heracles is an ancient god among the Egyptians. As they themselves say, it is 17,000 years to the reign of Amasis, counting from when the 12 gods came into being out of the 8 gods, of whom they reckon Heracles to be one. And wishing to know something certain about this matter, so far as it was possible, I sailed also to Tyre in Phoenicia, having learned that there was a holy shrine of Heracles there. And I saw it richly furnished with many other offerings, and in it were 2 pillars, one of pure gold, the other of emerald stone that shone at night with great brilliance. I fell into conversation with the gods' priests and asked them how long a time it had been since their shrine was founded. I found that they too did not agree with the Greeks, for they said that the shrine of the god was founded at the same time that Tyre was founded, and that it is 2,300 years since they have inhabited Tyre. I also saw in Tyre another shrine of Heracles, with the epithet Thasian. And I went as well to Thasos, where I found a shrine of Heracles established by the Phoenicians, who had sailed out in search of Europa and founded Thasos. And this too is 5 generations of men earlier than Heracles, the son of Amphitryon, came to be in Greece. Now these researches of mine clearly show that Heracles is an ancient god, and it seems to me that those Greeks act most correctly who have established and maintained 2 cults of Heracles, sacrificing to the one as to an immortal, under the title Olympian, and offering rites to the other as to a hero. The Greeks say many other things carelessly, and this tale too that they tell about Heracles is naive. That on his arrival in Egypt the Egyptians crowned him and led him out in procession as though about to sacrifice him to Zeus. And that he for a while kept still, but when they began the preliminary rites on him at the altar, he turned to force and slaughtered them all. To me it seems that in saying this the Greeks show themselves utterly ignorant of how the Egyptians live and what they hold sacred. For these people, for whom it is not even lawful to sacrifice cattle except swine, and male oxen and calves that are pure, and geese, how could they sacrifice human beings? Moreover, Heracles being one person, and, as they say, still a man, how could it be in his nature to slaughter many tens of thousands? Concerning these matters, may we have said thus much and still find favor with both the gods and the heroes. Now the reason the Egyptians named do not sacrifice she-goats and he-goats is this. The Mendesians count Pan among the 8 gods, and they claim these 8 came before the 12 gods did. And the painters and sculptors depict and carve the image of Pan just as the Greeks do, with the face of a goat and the legs of a goat, not because they think he is actually like this, but as being similar to the other gods. But for what reason they depict him thus, I would rather not say. The Mendesians hold every goat sacred, giving the males more honor than the females, and among these the goatherds hold greater honor. But of them one especially, whichever one dies, has great mourning proclaimed for it throughout the whole Mendesian district. Both the he-goat and Pan are called Mendes in the Egyptian tongue. In this district, in my own time, this marvel occurred. A he-goat coupled with a woman, openly. This came to public notice. Now the Egyptians consider the pig a foul animal, and in this regard, if anyone in passing touches a pig with his very clothes, he goes and dips himself, clothes and all, in the river. And swineherds, though native-born Egyptians, are the only people who enter no shrine anywhere in Egypt. Nor will anyone give a daughter in marriage to them, nor take a wife from among them, but swineherds give and take wives only among themselves. As for other gods, the Egyptians consider it wrong to offer them pigs at all, but to the moon and Dionysus alone, and at the same time, at the same full moon, they sacrifice the pigs and eat of the meat. As for why they detest pigs at the other festivals but sacrifice them at this one, there is an account told about it by the Egyptians, which, though I know it, is not more fitting for me to tell. The sacrifice of pigs to the moon is performed as follows. When one is sacrificed, he puts together the tip of the tail, along with the spleen and caul, wrapping them together in fat taken from around the animal's belly, and then burns them in the fire. The rest of the meat they eat at the full moon on which they perform the sacrifices, but on any other day they would no longer taste it. The poor among them, owing to scant means, mold pigs out of dough, bake them, and sacrifice these instead. For Dionysus, on the evening of his festival, each person slaughters a piglet before his doors and gives it to be carried off by the very swineherd from whom he bought it. The rest of the festival of Dionysus the Egyptians celebrate in almost the same way as the Greeks do, except for the dances. But instead of phalluses, they have other now such devices have been invented as cubit-high puppets worked with strings, which women carry around through the villages, the phallus nodding, and not much smaller than the rest of the body. A flute leads the way, and the women follow singing of Dionysus. As for why the phallus is oversized and it alone of the body moves, there is a sacred story told about it. Now it seems to me that Melampus, son of Amythaean, was not unacquainted with this rite, but well versed in it. For it is Melampus who introduced to the Greeks the name of Dionysus, the sacrifice, and the phallic procession. He did not, strictly speaking, grasp the whole matter and set it forth, but the wise men who came after him set it forth more fully. Still, it is Melampus who was the one who introduced the phallus carried in procession for Dionysus, and it is from him that the Greeks learned to do what they do. I say, then, that Melampus, having become a wise man, acquired the art of divination for himself, and having learned from Egypt, introduced to the Greeks many other things as well as the matters concerning Dionysus, changing only a few details of them. For I will not say that what is done in Egypt for the god, and what is done among the Greeks happened to coincide by chance, for then they would be in keeping with Greek custom, and not newly introduced. Nor indeed will I say that the Egyptians took this or any other custom from the Greeks. It seems to me most likely that Melampus learned about the matters of Dionysus from Cadmus of Tyre, and those who came with him from Phoenicia to the land now called Boeotia. And indeed the names of nearly all the gods have come to Greece from Egypt. That they have come from foreign lands I find to be so upon inquiry, and I think they have come chiefly from Egypt. For apart from Poseidon and the Dioscuri, as I have said before, and Hera and Hestia and Themis, and the Graces and the Nereids, the names of the rest of the gods have always existed in Egypt in that land. I say only what the Egyptians themselves say. As for the gods whose names they say they do not know, these, it seems to me, were named by the Pelasgians, except Poseidon, this god they learned of from the Libyans. For no one from the beginning has had the name of Poseidon except the Libyans, and they have always honored this god. The Egyptians, then, do not worship heroes at all. These practices, then, and others besides, which I shall describe, the Greeks have adopted from the Egyptians. But making images of Hermes with an erect phallus was learned not from Egypt but rather from the Pelasgians. The Athenians were the first of all the Greeks to adopt it, and from them, the rest. For at that time, Pelasgians had already become settlers among the Athenians, who by then were being reckoned as Greeks, and it is from that point that the Greeks began to be so reckoned. Whoever has been initiated into the rites of the Cabiri, which the Samothracians carry out, taking them over from the Pelasgians, such a person understands what I am referring to. For the Pelasgians who once dwelt with the Athenians formerly inhabited Samothrace, and it is from them that the Samothracians received the rites. So then, having the phallus of the images of Hermes erect, the Athenians were the first of the Greeks to learn this from the Pelasgians and to make it so. And the Pelasgians told a certain sacred story about it, one that the Samothracian mysteries reveal. Now the Pelasgians formerly, as I know from what I heard at Dodona, made all their offerings while praying to the gods, but they gave none of them a title or a name, for they had not yet heard of such things. They called them gods from the fact that, having set all things in order, they held all the divisions of the world in due arrangement. Then, after a great length of time had passed, they learned from Egypt the names of the other gods that had come from there, and much later still they learned the name of Dionysus. And after a time, they put a question to the oracle at Dodona regarding these names, since that oracle is reckoned the oldest among the oracles found in Greece, and it was then the only one in existence. So when the Pelasgians put to the Dodona oracle the question of whether they ought to accept the names that had reached them from foreign peoples, the oracle answered that they should use them. From that time on they employed the gods' names in their sacrifices, and it was from the Pelasgians that the Greeks later took them over. As to whence each of the gods arose, or whether they all existed forever, and what they looked like in form, they did not know until, so to speak, only the day before yesterday. For I reckon that Hesiod and Homer lived some 4 centuries earlier than my own time, no more, and it is these who composed a theogony for the Greeks, giving the gods their titles, distributing honors and skills among them, and describing their forms. The poets said to have lived before these men came, in my opinion, after them. Of these matters the first part is told by the priestesses of Dodona, and the later part, concerning Hesiod and Homer, I tell myself. Concerning the oracles, the one in Greece and the one in Libya, the Egyptians tell the following account. The priests of Zeus of Thebes said that 2 women, priestesses, were carried off from Thebes by Phoenicians, and that they learned one of them was sold into Libya and the other to the Greeks. And these women, they said, were the ones who established the first oracles among the peoples named. When I asked how they knew this so precisely to tell it, they replied that they themselves had conducted an extensive search on the matter and had been unable to find them, but that they later learned these things about them just as they had told them. This, then, is what I heard from the priests at Thebes. But the following is what the prophetesses of Dodona say, that two black doves flew up from Thebes in Egypt, and one of them came to Libya and the other to them, and that the one which came to them settled on an oak tree and spoke with a human voice, saying that it was necessary that an oracle of Zeus be established there, and that they understood this to be a divine command laid upon them, and so they did it accordingly. As for the dove that went off to the Libyans, they say it told the Libyans to establish the oracle of Ammon, and this too is an oracle of Zeus. The priestesses of Dodona, the eldest of whom was named Promnea, the next Timarete, and the youngest Nicandra, told these things, and the rest of the Dodonians about the shrine agreed with them. Now I hold this opinion about these matters. If the Phoenicians really did carry off the sacred women, selling one into Libya and disposing of the other in Greece, then it seems to me that this woman was sold to the people of what is now Greece, formerly called Pelasgia, this same land, sold to the Thesprotians. And there, while serving as a slave, she founded a shrine of Zeus beneath an oak tree growing on the spot, as was natural since she had been in service at the shrine of Zeus at Thebes, and there where she came she kept a memory of it. And from this she established the oracle, once she had learned the Greek tongue. And she said her sister had been sold off in Libya by those very same Phoenicians who had sold her. The women seem to me to have been given the name of doves by the Dodonians for this reason, because they were foreigners and seemed to them to speak like birds. Then after a time, they say, the dove began speaking with a human voice, once the woman spoke intelligibly to them. But while she still spoke a foreign tongue, she seemed to them to speak like a bird, for how could a dove speak with a human voice? And in saying she was black, they mean to indicate that the woman was Egyptian. And the manner of divination at Thebes in Egypt and at Dodona are in fact very similar to one another. Divination by means of sacrificial victims also has come from Egypt. Festivals, processions, and public assemblies were first established among men by the Egyptians, and from them the Greeks have learned. My evidence of this is the following. The Egyptian festivals appear to have been held from a very long time back, while the Greek ones were established only recently. The Egyptians hold festivals not once a year but many times, most importantly, and with the greatest devotion at the city of Bubastes in honor of Artemis, and second at the city of Busiris in honor of Isis. For in this city there is the greatest temple of Isis, and this city is situated at the center of Egypt's delta. Isis is, in the Greek tongue, Demeter. Third, they hold festival at the city of Sais in honor of Athena, fourth at the city of Heliopolis in honor of the sun, fifth at the city of Buto in honor of Leto, and sixth at the city of Papramis in honor of Ares. Now when they travel to the city of Bubastes, they do the following. Men and women sail together and a great crowd of each in every boat. Some of the women hold rattles and rattle them, some of the men play the flute the whole way, while the rest of the women and the men sing and clap their hands. Whenever, sailing along, they come near some other city, they bring the boat close to the shore and do the following. Some of the women do as I have described, while others shout out mocking taunts at the women of that city, some dance, and others stand up and lift their skirts. This they do at every city along the river, and when they arrive at Bubastes, they hold festival, offering great sacrifices, and more wine of the grape is consumed at this festival than in the whole of the remaining year. And they gather there, men and women together apart from children, to the number of 700,000, as the local people say. This, then, is what is done there, and how they conduct the festival of Isis at the city of Busiris I have said before. There, after the sacrifice, all the men and women, very many tens of thousands of people, beat themselves in mourning. But that they beat themselves, it is not right for me to say. But as for the Carians who live in Egypt, they do even more than this, in that they gash their foreheads with knives, and by this they show themselves to be foreigners and not Egyptians. When they have gathered at the city of Sais for the sacrifice, on the night of it they all burn many lamps in the open air around their houses in a circle. The lamps are shallow bowls filled with salt and oil, and the wick floats on top. This burns all night, and the festival is called the lamplighting. Those Egyptians who do not come to this gathering still keep the night of the sacrifice, and all of them likewise light lamps, so that the lighting takes place not only at Sais, but throughout all Egypt. As for why this night has been given light and honor, there is a sacred story told about it. At Heliopolis and Buto, they perform only the sacrifices, going there for that purpose. But at Papermis, they perform sacrifices and rites just as elsewhere. But when the sun begins to go down, a few of the priests busy themselves about the image, while most of them stand at the entrance of the temple holding wooden clubs, and others, performing vows, more than 1,000 men, each likewise holding wooden clubs, stand massed on the other side. The image, which is in a small wooden gilded shrine, gets carried out one day earlier to a different sacred building. The few who are left around the image drag a four-wheeled wagon carrying the shrine together with the statue housed within it. The others, standing in the forecourt, do not allow them to enter, and the men under vow, defending the god, strike them as they try to fend it off. There a fierce battle with clubs takes place, and heads are broken. And as I suppose many even die of their wounds, though the Egyptians said that no one dies. The local people say the origin of this festival is as follows. Ares's mother dwells in this temple, and Ares, having been raised elsewhere, came, now grown to manhood, wishing to be with his mother. And the attendants of the mother, since they had never seen him before, did not allow him to pass but kept him off. And he, having brought men from another city, roughly handled the attendants and went in to his mother. Because of this, they say, this blow-giving became customary for Ares at the festival. And the practice of not having intercourse with women in temples, and not entering temples unwashed after intercourse with a woman, these people were the first to observe as a religious rule. For nearly all other people, except the Egyptians and the Greeks, have intercourse in temples and enter a temple unwashed after rising from a woman, holding that men are no different from the other animals. For they see that other animals, and the various kinds of birds, mate both in the temples of the gods and in their sacred precincts, and reason that the god could not be displeased by it, or the animals would not do it either. This is the reasoning by which they justify what they do, but it does not please me. The Egyptians, however, are excessively scrupulous in matters of religion, in this as in other things. Egypt, though it borders on Libya, is not very rich in wild animals, but all the animals it does have are held sacred, some raised together with the people themselves, others not. As for the reasons why these animals are dedicated as sacred, if I were to tell them, I would descend in my account into matters divine, which I most avoid recounting. What I have said of them, I said only touching lightly on the subject, compelled by necessity. The custom concerning the animals is as follows. Keepers have been appointed for the feeding of each kind separately, both men and women among the Egyptians, and the office passes from father to son. Those in the cities each fulfill the following vows. Praying to the god whose animal it is, they shave the heads of their children, either the whole head or half or a third part of it, and weigh the hair against silver. Whatever it weighs in silver, they give this to the woman who tends the animals, and she in return cuts up fish and gives it as food to the animals. Such is the food that has been assigned to them. Whoever kills one of these animals, if deliberately, the penalty is death. If unintentionally, he pays whatever penalty the priest set. But whoever kills an ibis or a hawk, whether deliberately or unintentionally, must die. Although there are many animals that live together with people, they would become far more numerous still, were it not for what happens to the cats. When the females give birth, they no longer go to the males, and the males, wanting to mate with them, cannot. So against this, they devise the following scheme. They snatch the kittens away from the females and steal them and kill them, yet they refrain from eating them once killed. And the females, robbed of their young and hungry for more, thus come to the males, for the animal is fond of its young. And when a fire breaks out, wondrous things happen to the cats. The Egyptians stand apart in a line, keeping watch over the cats, and caring nothing about putting out the fire, the cats slip through or leap over the people and jump into the flames. When this happens, great grief seizes the Egyptians. In whatever house a cat dies of its own accord, all who live there shave only their eyebrows, but where a dog dies, they shave the whole body and head. Dead cats are carried off to sacred buildings, where, after being embalmed, they are buried at the city of Bubastes. Dogs are buried by each people in sacred coffins in their own city. Likewise, the ichneumons are buried along with the dogs. The shrewmice and hawks they carry off to Buto, delivering the ibises instead to the city of Hermes. Bears, which are scarce, and wolves, which are not much larger than foxes, they bury wherever they are found lying.